The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the October 13th, 2013 edition of The Week magazine. And as usual, we start with the main stories and how they were covered. Shutting down the government over Obamacare. What happened? The federal government ground to a halt this week for the first time in 17 years. After Republicans in Congress refused to continue funding it unless President Obama's signature health care law was defunded or delayed. The partial shutdown began on October 1st, after the Senate rejected an 11th-hour bill passed by the House to fund the government if the Affordable Care Act was delayed for 1 year. Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid ruled out any negotiations to weaken Obamacare, saying it had already been passed by Congress, survived Supreme Court review, and been ratified by Obama's 2012 re-election. "They've lost their minds," Reid said of the GOP. "We will not go to conference with a gun to our heads." As some government services were halted, each party tried to blame the other for the crisis. In a speech in which he was flanked by uninsured people with pre-existing conditions, President Obama called the Republican demands an ideological crusade to deny affordable health insurance to millions of Americans. Republicans said the president and Senate Democrats caused the shutdown by refusing to compromise. "The president says, 'I'm not going to negotiate,'" House Speaker John Boehner said. "It just doesn't work that way." What the editorial said. "This is John Boehner's shutdown," said the New York Times. If he had allowed a floor vote on a clean funding resolution to keep the government open, with no ridiculous demands, it would have passed with a strong majority because most Republicans are keenly aware of how badly this collapse will damage their party. But out of fear of angering 30 to 50 Tea Partiers, Boehner cynically is playing a destructive game he knows Republicans cannot win, proving conclusively that he and his party are incapable of governing. "House Republicans are now trapped in a mess of their own making," said the Wall Street Journal. "If they relent and pass a clean bill, the hardliners will denounce them as sellouts. But with polls showing that the public disapproves of using a shutdown to stop Obamacare by a 2-to-1 margin, a prolonged shutdown could badly damage the GOP heading into the 2014 midterms. Repealing Obamacare is not possible until Republicans win some elections." What the columnists said. "A partial shutdown hardly represents an unrivaled constitutional crisis," said Charles C.W. Cook in NationalReview.com. Former Democratic House Speaker Tip O'Neill, beloved by liberals for his supposed knack for bipartisan compromise, shut down the government 8 times during the Reagan administration. "Shutdowns are caused by legitimate and welcome disagreement between equal branches and are resolved only when both sides compromise. Obamacare is already a mess and should be delayed. What stands out here is not the shutdown itself, but the president and Harry Reid's public refusal even to engage with Republicans. Republicans aren't interested in negotiation," said Ezra Klein in the Washington Post. "Compromise requires sacrifice from both parties. But in return for their demand to gut health care reform, Republicans aren't willing to give up anything of value to them. Agreeing to fund the government or to raise the debt ceiling in 2 weeks isn't making a concession. It's releasing a hostage. And that hostage is the U.S. economy. This is pure power politics, said William Salatin in Slate.com. And the standoff will end only when public anger grows and the GOP decides to cut its losses. This fight goes way beyond health care, said Jonathan Cohn in NewRepublic.com. It's a crisis of political legitimacy. The far right doesn't believe Obama or the Democrats have any right to govern at all. In that context, it's perfectly acceptable to shut down the government or refuse to raise the debt ceiling to undo the results of Democratic elections. But Tea Party Republicans don't have to speak for the whole party. As many as 175 House Republicans would reportedly be prepared to vote for a clean bill. John Boehner has a duty to put the Tea Partiers in their place before they do real harm to the country, even if it sparks a challenge to his leadership. It will mean taking political risk, but that's what leaders do. The second article, the shutdown's toll. The impact of the first partial government shutdown in 17 years rippled across the nation this week as federal agencies and parks were shuttered, and around 800,000 federal employees deemed non-essential were sent home without pay. More than 400 national parks and attractions, including the Statue of Liberty and the Grand Canyon, were closed to the public. Food safety inspections were cut back, and the National Institutes of Health announced that for every week of the shutdown, it would have to turn away about 10 children seeking cancer treatment. It's heartbreaking, said NIH Director Francis Collins. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, meanwhile, said it had furloughed scientists who study and track disease outbreaks. I am losing sleep because we don't know if we'll be able to find and stop things that might kill people, said CDC Director Tom Frieden. But most essential government services, and many that are not, will continue to function as usual, said Michael Tanner in NationalReview.com. The U.S. Postal Service will keep delivering mail, and air traffic controllers will stay on the job, as will FBI employees. Seniors will still receive Social Security and Medicare benefits, and uniformed soldiers will get their paychecks. This is really less of a government shutdown and more of a much-needed downsizing. The economic damage caused by this shutdown can't be so easily dismissed, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. The government estimates that the 28-day shutdown of 1995-96 cost around $2 billion in today's dollars. But that didn't account for the lost value of work that wasn't done, or the $300 million the federal parks would have taken in, or the reduced pace of IRS audits. The pain for basically everyone will only increase as the shutdown drags on, said Tim Murphy in MotherJones.com. The housing market could suffer a blow as the Federal Housing Administration, which guarantees 30% of home mortgages, isn't approving new loans. Students could see their loans and Pell Grants delayed thanks to cutbacks at the Department of Education. Some 9 million at-risk mothers and children could go hungry as federal food assistance programs run out of cash. Members of Congress, though, will continue receiving their salaries. For the controversy of the week, climate change. Why aren't people more alarmed? Humans are warming the planet, said Brad Plummer in WashingtonPost.com, just as surely as smoking causes cancer. That's the conclusion of a new report by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which stated that there is now 95% certainty that mankind's greenhouse gas emissions are driving climate change. The IPCC warned that to limit warming to the 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, beyond which changes would become truly dangerous, the world cannot exceed a total of 1,000 gigatons in total carbon dioxide emissions. We've already emitted 531 gigatons over the past century. With the burning of oil, natural gas, and coal still proceeding unchecked, we may race to 1,000 gigatons in the next 25 years. The worst-case scenario can still be averted, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, but not without an end to the willful distortions of the climate change deniers. The first step in Carbonaholics Anonymous is admitting that we have a problem. Actually, we still don't know how serious that problem is, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Buried in the report from the professional alarmist is an inconvenient truth. Based on the carbon dioxide emissions since 1990, the IPCC climate change models predicted warming of up to 0.9 degrees Celsius. Instead, the warming was 0.1 degrees Celsius, almost flat. Since it's now clear that scientists can't reliably predict how CO2 affects climate, now is the time for policy caution, not wildly expensive schemes to restrict emissions. There's no doubt that some warming is occurring, said Bjorn Lomborg in Time.com, but the apocalyptic scenarios promoted by Al Gore, global droughts and famines, 20-foot sea level rises permanently submerging Florida and Bangladesh, were way overblown. Rather than clamoring for draconian emissions limits no country will abide by, climate activists should demand more funding for basic energy research, hastening the day that clean, renewable energy becomes cheaper than oil. The usual suspects are spinning at relativistic speeds trying to downplay this report, says Phil Plate in Slate.com. But its bottom line truly is alarming. The last decade was by far the warmest on record, and there's strong evidence that it wasn't warmer still only because the extra heat is being absorbed by the deeper waters of the ocean. Meanwhile, rainfall patterns are changing. Arctic sea ice has continued to melt, the oceans are growing more acidic, and the amount of CO2 in our atmosphere is now at its highest level in 800,000 years. Unfortunately, said Adam Corner in New Scientist, climate change denial has more to do with politics and values than hard science. Conservatives don't believe in government regulation or international meddling in free markets. Therefore, they refuse to accept that climate change is real. Climate activists should stop relying on left-wing ideas and language and use terms that resonate with the right, such as safeguarding their children's future. This is an ideological issue for liberals as much as it is for conservatives, said Kathy Young in Newsday. Many activists have embraced climate change as a quasi-religious crusade, an opportunity to rid the planet of nasty SUVs, power plants, and consumer greed, and return us all to Mother Earth. They are therefore eager to embrace the worst-case climate scenarios and to demand drastic curbs on consumption, rather than consider scientific and technological solutions. If climate change activists want more influence over public opinion, they'll have to stop demanding simplistic solutions and engaging in ideological zealotry. Well, it was a good week for the Greatest Generation after a group of veterans broke through barricades to enter Washington's World War II Memorial, which had been closed by the government shutdown. We took on the Germans and the Japs, and we whipped them, said Tom Lucas, 87. And then we have to take this sort of thing? It was a good week for courtly love. After San Diego Judge Patricia Cookson officiated a marriage between convicted killer Dan Desbro and his fiancée, right after sentencing the groom to 53 years in prison for murder. It was a good week for true believers after a group called the Sasquatch Genome Project unveiled new video and DNA analysis that it insists prove Bigfoot is real. "We think it's a human hybrid," said genetic scientist Melba Ketchum. "This is a serious study." It was a bad week for nuclear technology after a massive cluster of jellyfish forced one of the world's largest nuclear reactors, Oskarshamn, in southeastern Sweden, to shut down for 3 days. Several tons of jellyfish had to be cleaned out of the pipes that suck in cooling seawater. It was a bad week for getaways after a fugitive attempted to escape Michigan police by frantically pedaling a paddle boat across a lake. When the boat capsized and sank, Mark Rude swam back to shore and was arrested. And it was a bad week for going carbon neutral after a Wisconsin meteorologist burst into tears, vowed to never fly again, and pledged to get a vasectomy after reading the latest United Nations report on climate change. "No children, happy to go extinct," Eric Holthaus told his 13,000 followers on Twitter. Turn now over to the briefing page and find this headline: "The Quest for Immortality. Scientists are starting to unlock the secrets of aging. Will human beings one day be able to live forever? How long can humans live? The maximum human lifespan is currently about 125 years, scientists think. Most people fall far short of that because of poor diet, self-destructive habits, disease, or organ failure. But advances in medicine have already extended the average human lifespan in the U.S. and other modern nations from 46 in 1900 to 78 today. And science is now making steady progress towards solving the problem of aging itself. Through genetic manipulation, scientists are hoping to train the body's immune system to destroy cancer cells and to tweak our DNA to prevent our healthy cells from dying. We may be approaching an era in which people can bring their aging bodies to a clinic for maintenance, like a car, and have new organs installed that were grown from stem cells or manufactured by 3D printers. I'd say we have a 50-50 chance of bringing aging under what I'd call a decisive level of medical control within the next 25 years or so, says gerontologist Aubrey de Grey. What is aging exactly? Scientists don't agree on a definition. One theory puts it in terms of oxidation. Just as the oxygen in air causes a cut apple to turn brown or a piece of iron to rust, the oxygen used in human metabolic processes introduces free radicals that can damage cells. Over time, those cells die. In simple language, we don't get old. We rust from oxygen, noted pathologist Harry B. Demopoulos once said. Other scientists see aging through the lens of entropy. According to the second law of thermodynamics, all living and non-living systems inevitably break down, lose energy, and degrade to a state of inert disorder, death. Are there ways of avoiding this decline? So far, there are only ways of slowing it down. One way to lengthen life in at least some creatures is, paradoxically, through near starvation. Scientists have found that caloric restriction extends the lives of fish, rats, roundworms, and some other species by 30 to 40%. No trials have been conducted on humans, and an experiment on rhesus monkeys found that caloric deprivation produced no increases in lifespan. Still, some true believers called skinnies, swear by a diet of only 1,200 calories a day, less than half of what people usually consume. They're gaunt and hungry, but they're convinced they'll get 10 or 20 extra years of life. Is there a better alternative? Several labs around the world are working on replacing failing organs with new ones using stem cell technology. In July, Japanese scientists announced that they had grown the world's first functioning miniature livers from human skin cells. As the science of stem cells and organ building progresses, it may become possible to use a 3D printer to print our new organs on demand. Researchers have already managed to print out a fully beating three-dimensional mouse heart. Since the cause of most deaths is organ failure, says Anthony Atala, director of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine, finding an easy way to produce replacement organs would extend life by several decades. Some scientists are even looking for a cure for aging itself. How could aging be cured? Scientists are focusing on the idea of genetically manipulating mysterious stretches of our DNA called telomeres. Like the plastic tips on the end of shoelaces, telomeres prevent our chromosomes from fraying. But as our cells repeatedly divide over the course of years to renew the body, telomeres become shorter and frayed. Until cells can divide no more, and grow old and die. If we could somehow manipulate our genes to prevent telomeres from degenerating, then it might be possible to stop aging. So is immortality a possibility? Russian multimillionaire Dmitry Itskov certainly thinks so. He's pumped millions into his 2045 initiative, vowing to cure death within the next three decades. Then there's Google's director of engineering, Ray Kurzweil, who predicts that humans will simply merge with computers, uploading our consciousness and memories and becoming immortal super beings. So determined is Kurzweil to beat death that he gobbles up to 250 vitamins and other pills a day that he believes will help him live until 2045, when he says immortality will become a reality. Should we want to live forever? The idea fills many with dread. Consider a world in which millions of 150-year-olds roamed an already overcrowded planet, placing the environment and our welfare system under incredible strain. Then there are the unforeseen cultural effects. Would people bother having children if they didn't need to live on through their offspring? Would the institution of marriage crumble under the prospect of 100-year or eternal relationships? Ethicist Leon Cass argues that finite lifespans are necessary for treasuring and appreciating all that life brings. But some scientists refuse to accept that death is beyond human control. It's such a profoundly sad, lonely feeling that I can't really bear it, Kurzweil says. So I go back to thinking about how I'm not going to die. And we take a look now at the best columns from the U.S. First comes from Peter Wehner, W-E-H-N-E-R, from CommentaryMagazine.com. The Foolish War on Rhinos, that's R-I-N-O. My fellow conservatives have an excommunication problem, said Peter Wehner. In their passion for their principles, many purists now insist on judging every Republican public official and conservative pundit by a series of litmus tests. This impulse is now on display in the bitter battle over Obamacare. Representative Pete Sessions of Texas, a rock-solid conservative with a 97% rating from the American Conservative Union, is being denounced by Tea Party activists as a traitor and a RINO, R-I-N-O, Republican in name only, for opposing the government shutdown effort led by Senator Ted Cruz. Sessions felt that shutting down the government would only hurt the GOP. Sadly, a growing number of conservatives now demand that any Republican who doesn't conform to a rigid ideology be kicked out of office. This excommunication impulse is not in the movement's interest. If a similar litmus test had been applied to Ronald Reagan when he was governor of California, when he signed into law a record tax hike and liberalized California's abortion law, he would have been cast aside as a RINO. Pragmatism in the defense of liberty is no vice. From Ashley Merriman at the New York Times, giving every kid a trophy. Losing is good for you, said Ashley Merriman. But as your children return to school in fall sports, they are stepping back into a fantasy land where everybody is a winner and everybody gets a trophy. Trophies were once rare things, but manufacturers now churn out $3 billion worth of them a year. In one California youth soccer league, every player gets at least one trophy, and a third get two. Our kids are not fooled. By age five, research shows that they are surprisingly accurate in identifying who excels and who struggles. Telling them that everything they do is wonderful does not inspire children to succeed. It undermines their motivation to compete and strive for excellence, breeds narcissism, and leaves them unprepared for life's inevitable failures, which come as a crushing shock. Think about how those traits play out once young people go to competitive colleges or move out into the work world. Losing teaches children about their strengths and weaknesses, about persistence, and about graciousness in defeat. It helps build character. To raise successful kids, we need fewer trophies and more losing. From Emily Bazelon at Slate.com, Stopping Revenge Porn. Revenge porn is a scourge, said Emily Bazelon. The internet is full of sites in which creepy men post sexual photos of women, often exes, without their consent. The vengeful men often post the names and email addresses of their victims, along with epithets such as Jap Slut. Once the images are online, they are impossible to eradicate and come back to haunt victims for years, cropping up on actual porn sites and in Google searches. Victims have lost their jobs and had to change their names. It's as cruel and humiliating as cyber harassment gets, and lawmakers are finally waking up to it. California passed a bill earlier this month making it a misdemeanor offense to post revenge porn online. But the bill only goes halfway, requiring a prosecutor to prove intentional emotional distress. The only way to stop revenge porn is to make it a federal crime to put any sexual images of a person online without the subject's consent, and to crack down on sites that make money hosting revenge porn. If we prosecute child pornographers, why not those bitter, bullying exes who willfully ruin women's lives? I found another one of these shorts in the It Must Be True. I read it in the tabloids that I just couldn't resist. O.J. Simpson was caught red-handed trying to steal more than a dozen cookies from a Nevada prison cafeteria, says the National Enquirer. The former gridiron great, who is serving 33 years for armed robbery, was walking to his cell after lunch when a guard noticed a bulge in his jumpsuit. Everyone thought he had smuggled in a cell phone, said a source. So when the guard started pulling oatmeal cookies out of O.J.'s shirt, the other inmates started laughing so hard they nearly fell over. Simpson, who has swelled to more than 300 pounds in jail, received a warning. The Last Word article this week is called Figuring Out Obamacare. Across the U.S., said Katie Thomas and Reed Abelson, currently uninsured people are trying to do the math. The insurance marketplaces that form the centerpiece of President Obama's health care law opened on Tuesday, a crucial turning point for millions of Americans who will finally get the chance to square the law's lofty ambitions with their own personal needs. While some people desperate for coverage will need no persuading to sign up, for others the decision will amount to a series of complicated calculations. Are the new plans less expensive or more generous than existing ones? How do premiums and out-of-pocket costs compare? Are the networks of doctors and hospitals the most desirable? Who qualifies for how much of a subsidy? And what is the tax penalty for miscalculation? How millions of people answer these questions over the next 6 months will be vital to determining whether the Affordable Care Act lives up to its name and its ambitious goal of helping more people buy the coverage they need. Much is at stake for the insurers as well. They must attract enough healthy people to pay for the care of sicker patients and price their offerings to keep premiums low enough to be competitive, but high enough to be sustainable. As the state insurance exchanges were set to open, we talked to people around the country who would be among the first to give them a test drive. For some, the law could provide welcome relief from mounting medical bills. For others, a break from rising premiums. Still others must decide whether insurance is right for them at all. Mitchell McGovern, 26, lives in Brooklyn and works part-time at a Crate and Barrel store in Manhattan. He earns about $15,000 a year and does not have health insurance of any kind. A bout with pneumonia in January sent him to the doctor's office, which cost him $75 and $150 for medication. McGovern said he would love to buy health insurance, and he was mindful that the law requires him to do so, but only if it cost him less than $100 a month. I live paycheck to paycheck, he explained. McGovern is exactly the sort of person the Obama administration needs to enroll in the new insurance marketplaces if the federal health care law is to succeed. Young, healthy people who until now have not been covered by insurance, either because they couldn't afford it or because it wasn't a priority. If a critical mass of these people doesn't enroll, the federal government hopes to sign up about 2.7 million of them, the premiums for plans offered on the exchanges could skyrocket and cause the market to fail as fewer and fewer people take part. McGovern's current income will probably qualify him, just barely, for Medicaid in New York State. But for McGovern and others like him, predicting how much he will make even a few months from now is hard, and he may end up qualifying instead for tax credit subsidies in the state marketplace. His uncertain financial situation is typical of the population most likely to consider the insurance marketplaces, said C.C. Connolly of the Health Research Institute at PricewaterhouseCoopers. Only about 51% will have full-time jobs, with a median annual income of about $21,700. She said 38% of the people expected to enroll will end up shuttling several times between Medicaid and the marketplaces over the next 4 years. Lavelle D. White is also 26 and getting by without health insurance. Unlike McGovern, however, he knows he has a health issue. A documentary filmmaker who lives in Louisville, he has high blood pressure. He said he has to pay out of pocket for doctor visits and sometimes doesn't refill his medicine because he doesn't have insurance. To help millions of low-income Americans afford coverage, the law created subsidies that can bring down the cost of a policy. The most expensive plans, at the platinum level, will limit the amount people have to pay toward a doctor's bill or hospital stay, while the least expensive bronze plans may require significant out-of-pocket spending. Under federal law, all plans cap the annual amount that someone must pay for care at $6,350. The Obama administration has estimated that a 27-year-old with an income of $25,000 will be eligible for a silver plan, a moderately priced policy for $145 a month. White said he had researched his options for enrolling and found them reasonable. His income varies. Last year he made about $11,000, and this year he expects to make around $16,000. He will be eligible for Medicaid if he earns less than $16,000, but if he makes about $20,000, he will pay about $67 a month for the second least expensive silver plan offered in Kentucky. All insurance plans offered in the marketplace must cover White's preventive care, but how much his medication will cost will depend on the details of the version he selects. 5 years ago, Jennifer Vaught was treated for thyroid cancer. She had insurance through her employer, but she now works for herself as a freelance arts writer without insurance. Premiums for private health coverage have been too high. Vaught, who is 44 and lives in Boca Raton, Florida, knows she needs insurance and is eager to sign up in the state marketplace. "You really can't live without it," she said. She skipped a recent scan to check if the cancer had returned because, she said, she couldn't afford it. Vaught does not know whether she is eligible for a subsidy. She said she could afford a policy costing $500 a month and would be willing to pay as much as $700, even if it meant sacrifices like eating out less often. She hopes she can find a policy in that range in the Florida marketplace. Another concern is whether the plans being offered will include her doctors. "Because I'm a cancer survivor, I have really good relationships with my doctors here," she said. But she would sacrifice even those relationships to get health coverage at this point. "I live with that constant fear if I go out tomorrow and have an accident, I'm going to lose everything," she said. "I would completely go bankrupt." Ann Villanueva of Seattle has a different set of questions, but like Vaught, no easy answers. Villanueva, 27, works as a freelance transcriber and sells pillows and hair accessories on the website Etsy.com. She recently learned that her insurance company would terminate her at year-end, would terminate at year-end the plan she now buys privately. The option that the insurer offered instead come with higher deductibles and less generous drug coverage. Villanueva takes the drug Enbrel for rheumatoid arthritis. The drug, though costly, is paid for through an assistance program run by Amgen, its manufacturer. That program also covers her current deductible. She is leaning toward buying insurance under Washington State's marketplace because she thinks that the out-of-pocket cost will be lower. But it is still unclear how drug companies like Amgen will cover patients' drug costs in the marketplaces. The Federal Department of Health and Human Services is still determining whether the marketplaces should be considered federal programs. If they are, drug assistance programs could be characterized as government kickbacks and rendered illegal. The drug companies could indirectly cover patients' costs through nonprofit foundations, but those details have not been worked out. "I don't know what I'm going to do if I don't find something better," she said. "I'm still freaking out, but I'm also slightly excited to see what the health insurance exchange is going to be like and what it's going to offer me." People in their 50s and 60s are often charged very high premiums because of their age. But Jesus and Soya Cantu have been looking forward to the new law. "I was trying to get some insurance when all this happened," Jesus said. "It has been years since Jesus, 55, and an independent contractor in El Campo, Texas, had coverage. His wife, 63, who was a teacher's aide, lost her insurance when the school district eliminated her job, and she worked as a substitute instead. Last summer, Soya had double vision and trouble focusing. After going to various doctors, whom the Cantus paid themselves, Soya received a diagnosis of an aggressive form of leukemia. She has been treated for more than 2 months, and the bill at the end of August was $650,000. The hospital, Jesus said, called them to ask for a payment for $500,000. "The best I can do is $5,000, Jesus recalled telling the hospital representative. He told the hospital he would try to pay that amount every month. Before his wife's cancer diagnosis, the Cantus were financially comfortable, and they believe they make too much money to qualify for any assistance. Now they are deeply in debt because of the cost of Soya's care. Jesus said he has been waiting to enroll in the health care marketplace. I wanted to get us prepared for Obamacare, and I didn't want to pay a fine. But while he expects to enroll for coverage for next year, the law won't help him with his wife's medical bills, which he estimates now approach $1 million, if not more. Where am I going to get that kind of money?" he said. "In 20 years, I wouldn't be able to pay it off." This article was adapted from a piece that originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll pick up one of the obituaries this week. The woman who was the Beat's muse and lover, Carolyn Cassidy, 1923 to 2013. Had it not been for Carolyn Cassidy, the hip aura of the Beat generation might have adhered to Denver rather than to San Francisco. It was Carolyn's decision to move to California that prompted her lover, Neil Cassidy, to pursue her there, and his famous literary friends Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg soon followed. "Carolyn was more than a muse to the Beats," said Jerry Cimino, founder of San Francisco's Beat Museum. "In many ways, she was the power behind the throne." Carolyn Robinson was born to an academic family in East Lansing, Michigan, and educated at Bennington College in Vermont, said the Washington Post. She was studying theater in Denver when she met Cassidy, a fast-talking car thief and hustler with literary ambitions. She began dating him even though he was married to a 16-year-old, Lou Ann Henderson, and she soon fell in with his circle of exuberant, unconventional friends. She didn't realize that Kerouac was in love with Cassidy, however, or that Cassidy was in love with Ginsberg, a fact that came to light when she found Neil, Lou Ann, and Ginsberg in bed together. She broke up with Cassidy and moved to San Francisco, but he followed her there and convinced her to marry him in 1948. "The honeymoon bliss lasted maybe 6 months, said the San Francisco Chronicle. Cassidy left his wife and infant daughter behind and used their life savings to buy a car to drive to New York City, collect Kerouac, and come back. That epic trip westward later formed the basis of Kerouac's era-defining 1957 novel, On the Road, with Carolyn immortalized as the whining wife Camille. In San Francisco, Kerouac moved in with the Cassidys and, at Neil's urging, began an affair with Carolyn. But her daughter Jamie said she objected to being seen as a mere sexual plaything for the two men. It was pure love, Jamie said. Cassidy was both an eager participant in the Beat Generation's wild adventures and a dissenting adult, said the New York Times. But Neil's imprisonment in the late 1950s for marijuana possession was the last straw. The Cassidys divorced in 1963, and Neil died 5 years later at the age of 41. Cassidy spent her later years in England, where she was often sought out by fans of the Beat writers. In her 1990 memoir, Off the Road, she noted that their short lives were essentially unhappy. Everyone assumed the Beat Generation lived in a constant state of manic joy, she said, but they were weak. They suffered like crazy for what they couldn't conform to. They just couldn't get their lives to fit. On the health and science page, a setback for hope of life on Mars. After sampling Martian air for more than a year, NASA's Curiosity rover has detected almost no methane, dimming the prospects of finding life on the planet. Previous measurements made by telescopes and orbiting spacecraft suggested that Mars might harbor large quantities of the gas, which could be a sign of microbial life. Curiosity's failure to detect methane on the planet's surface is a little disheartening, mission scientist Sushil K. Atreya tells the Los Angeles Times. If there were a lot of methane, it would imply a lot of things. It opens up the possibility of life. Methane's absence, however, doesn't necessarily rule out life. Many types of bacteria don't produce methane, and it's possible that bacteria exist elsewhere on the planet, far from Curiosity's base. It's even plausible that methane disappears more quickly from the thin Martian atmosphere than from Earth's, making it much harder for Curiosity to detect it, says mission scientist Paul Mahaffey. Curiosity has found evidence that Martian soil contains significant amounts of water, and that the planet was once covered in lakes and streams that could have supported life in the past. It's disappointing in that we don't get a pony for Christmas, Mars Society President Robert Zubrin says of the lack of methane. But it doesn't mean there aren't ponies out there. Health scare of the week. The hidden danger in Tylenol. Roughly 150 Americans die each year and tens of thousands are hospitalized after overdosing on acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol and hundreds of other over-the-counter pain relievers. A new report by the nonprofit news organization ProPublica reveals that acetaminophen is the country's leading cause of acute liver failure, and that even a small overdose can be deadly. The key issue with acetaminophen is really what they call the narrow margin of error, report author T. Christian Miller tells CNN.com. It's really a pretty safe medicine at the recommended doses. But if you exceed those doses over time, even by as little as 2 extra-strength Tylenol tablets a day, you can get into trouble with things like liver damage and even death. Some 78,000 Americans each year arrive in emergency room after overdosing on acetaminophen. And a recent poll found that about 50% of Americans were unaware that Tylenol shouldn't be combined with alcohol, which increases the risk of liver damage. Infants and children's Tylenol can be especially dangerous when administered incorrectly. If you're a parent, Miller says, the number one thing is to follow what the label says. Hawaii's molasses mess. A massive molasses spill in Honolulu Harbor is wreaking havoc on local marine life. Some 233,000 gallons of the brown goo leaked into the harbor from a broken pipeline belonging to the shipping firm Matson. And cleanup crews say the spill has already killed 26,000 fish. It came as a shock to all of us, Robert Harris, director of the Sierra Club of Hawaii, tells fizz.org. I don't think any of us were aware molasses even existed in Hawaii. The viscous sugar product is heavier than oil and may be harder to remove. Instead of coating the surface of the water, where skimming could remove it, the molasses sank to the bottom, blanketing coral reefs and oxygen-producing seagrass. That led to the suffocation of fish and other marine creatures. Officials fear sharks will come in droves to eat the dead fish and are warning people to stay out of the water. Experts believe bacteria will eventually consume the molasses, but they don't know what impact those bacteria will have on the environment. We've never had a molasses spill, said Hawaii Pacific University oceanographer David B. Field. So I guess you could consider this an enormous experiment of the most unfortunate kind. And on the Talking Points page, we have yet another take on Obamacare. A change for the better or the worse? It is the most contentious and least understood law of our age, said Bob Burnett in HuffingtonPost.com. As the Affordable Care Act's health insurance exchange is open for business this week, an ABC News Washington Post poll found that 62% of the public admitted they didn't understand what the law would actually do. Despite all the hoopla, most people will never notice it, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. The 80% of Americans who get health insurance through employers or Medicare and Medicaid will not be affected by the Affordable Care Act, except to enjoy more protection from their insurance companies. For the 20% of Americans who are uninsured or already buy their own insurance, the ACA is very good news. They will now be able to buy private insurance through competitive exchanges set up in every state. Thanks to subsidies for low and middle income citizens, the competition between providers, the Department of Health and Human Services estimated that 56% of the people who are uninsured will pay less than $100 per month for policies. People with pre-existing conditions will buy policies with the same rates as healthy people. It's estimated that half of the 50 million Americans currently without insurance will have coverage by the end of the decade. That all sounds wonderful, said James Toronto in WSJ.com. But there's a fundamental flaw at the heart of Obamacare. The White House says it needs at least 2.7 million healthy 18 to 34-year-olds in the exchanges to offset the cost of providing care for the millions of older and sicker uninsured people. The administration is trying to bully young people into signing up by penalizing the uninsured. In 2014, they'll have to pay a fine of $95, or 1% of income, whichever is higher. But many young people are barely making ends meet, and may well decide it's cheaper to pay that small fine than a monthly premium of $100 or more. Without those healthy youngsters in the insurance pool, premiums cost will soon soar. Well-meaning government intervention always has unintended consequences, says DeRoy Murdoch in NationalReview.com, and Obamacare is no exception. Since the law requires companies with more than 50 employees to provide health insurance to those who work 30 hours or more per week, at least 313 businesses have decided to slash the hours of 30,377 workers to under 30 hours. These employees will suffer pay cuts of more than 25%. This is the cruelty that Obamacare is unleashing on American workers. The quality of care offered under this unwieldy law will also be substandard, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Insurance companies already admit that the only way they can provide customers with affordable policies is to severely limit the network of physicians and hospitals they can access. Forget about seeing that specialist and queue up at the community hospital. The Affordable Care Act might have its limits and flaws, said Josh Barrow in BusinessInsider.com. But what's the alternative? Republicans have discussed a vague plan that would offer large tax deductions to individuals who buy their own insurance. They also say they'd create high-risk pools to cover sick people excluded from the traditional insurance market. But any plan that extends coverage to millions of people would cost a lot of taxpayer money to implement, probably $15 billion or more a year or more. That makes it a non-starter for conservatives. Republicans would rather cover their eyes and pretend everything's fine with our dysfunctional health system, which forces taxpayers to spend $49 billion a year subsidizing emergency room care for uninsured Americans. Returning to the status quo is not an option, said Jonathan Cohn in NewRepublic.com. The percentage of Americans with employer-based insurance has dropped from 70% in 2000 to just 58% today. One out of six Americans has no coverage at all. People with chronic illness can't get jobs for fear of losing coverage, and every year about 2 million are hit with devastating medical bills that push them into bankruptcy. The ACA's fixes for these problems are complicated and full of compromises made to get it passed. But the important question is not whether the ACA will be perfect or without glitches. The question is whether the reforms improve on a broken, incredibly costly system, or whether restoring the old system, the one that caused so much misery, is a better alternative. And we'll finish up today with a quote from Meryl Streep. You can't get spoiled if you do your own ironing. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.